From Buffalo Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, Producer Picks. Highlights of conversations heard on previous episodes. On today's show,
taking Africana Studies courses, just about all admit that they haven't heard of hardly any of the names, the events, the places, and significant historical situations that have something to do with Black folks.
Marcus Watson, Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Individualized Studies at Buffalo State University. And we close with...
So those are rules or policies, right? Norms that have been ingrained in our way of life. So when you think about smoke-free norms, the goal here is to protect and save lives by reducing exposure to secondhand smoke.
Rashawn Smalls, the program manager for Tobacco-Free Erie Niagara through CAI Global. I'm Michael Loss. First, we revisit Jay Moran's conversation with Marcus Watson, an associate professor of Africana Studies and Individualized Studies at Buffalo State University. The two discuss his Intro to Africana Studies courses, as well as his work in the Peace Corps while working in South Africa shortly after apartheid.
We got a lot to talk about here, and I want to get into one of the things that you brought up to me just as we were starting off. You have an Intro to Africana Studies course, and I mean, we take intro courses, of course, because we want to learn more about things, but I'd like to think that in a lot of other fields, you walk in and to an intro course, you probably have some understanding, maybe more than just a little bit of understanding. But you, from what you explained to me, that's not necessarily the case with a lot of your students.
That is correct. I've been teaching courses like this in Africana Studies for some time. I was at the University of Wyoming for 9 years, and I was partly in the Black Studies or Africana Studies program there as well. So I taught courses like this there, and now I'm teaching at Buffalo State for 4 years in Africana Studies. And yes, one thing that is a clear pattern is that the students who are mostly first-year students, just graduated from high school, taking Africana Studies courses, just about all admit that they haven't heard of hardly any of the names, the events, the places, and significant, historical situations that have something to do with Black folks, whether it's in the U.S. or globally. And it's concerning on a number of levels. I mean, it's one thing if you walk into an intro course for a different major, a different discipline, and you don't know much, especially if those courses are not about a people, especially from an historical perspective, a much maligned and oppressed people. But Africana Studies is different than a lot of those majors in the sense that it is about bringing the thoughts and the experiences of African people, wherever they may be in the world, to the light of day, right? It's that one place on a university campus, or one of very few places on a university campus, where students get exposure, right, to African thought, right? Africana Studies is where Black thought matters, right? We talk about Black Lives Matter from the perspective of higher ed, right? Africana Studies is where Black thought matters, or is supposed to matter, right? So for students to have almost no clue about anyone or anything other than Dr. King and Rosa Parks and maybe a few others is alarming in itself, because from an Africana perspective, we have an understanding that most fundamentally, education is about the survival of a people, right? So it says a lot, right, about Black folks and our efforts at survival, right, if the education system is not helping in that regard. It's also enlightening in a sense, because what tends to be in the news, I think, is the banning,
right,
of Africana studies type of courses in places like Florida. And we in the North, and maybe in New York in particular, many of us, it's easy, I think, for us to look at Florida and wag a big finger at them. How dare they? But the more I do Africana studies here in the North and realize that our education system is producing young folks who also have no clue about Black history, it makes it clear that the methods of erasing Black history might be different, but the value is the same.
Right. That's a very powerful way to describe that reality. But, you know, it's a long time ago when I was in high school, so I can't, you know, but I don't remember, like you said, Martin Luther King, maybe Rosa Parks, and then pretty much anything else would have been, centered around what white presidents may or may not have done. Let's maybe just get into just a little bit of your Africana studies. So I walk in day one. What's opening my eyes? Like you said, most of them, I'm coming in like everybody else. I don't know a lot of the dates, and I don't know a lot of the events. What are some of those that really seem to capture your students' attention?
I think Gloria Richardson is someone who captures their attention. From 1962 to 1964, she led what was called the Cambridge Movement in Maryland. Civil rights movement, segregation was how things worked there. Blacks on one side of a street, whites on the other side of a street. And she got into the movement, she became the leader of it. And she herself represented a transition from the classical civil rights movement that we associate with Dr. King, the nonviolent types of resistance, the efforts at integrating into the system of exploitation, if you will, the transition from that to the Black Power movement, which was much more, if you mess with me, we got trouble. I want freedom now. Right. No excuses. So she represents a kind of transition figure. And she's most famous for a photograph in which she is walking in the street and she's walking past someone in the military, a white male, who has a bayonet gun pointing in her direction. And she's looking at him, staring right into his face and pushing the gun away. I let students look at that image for a minute because it's powerful. Now, she's a transitionary figure, I would say, because she still wants in, like Dr. King in the classical civil rights, but she wants integration. But you could tell that she wasn't very tolerant of doing it slowly, right, or turning another cheek. Right. And so she started, you know, getting into that Black Power approach, right, to trying to rebalance relations, right, between people in this country. So she's someone who captures the imagination of the students. And not least because during the famous March on Washington, there were, first of all, very few women included in it. But she was on stage and was scheduled to speak. But when she went up and took the microphone, all she could utter was hello before the microphone was taken from her.
Oh.
And it is said that because the dominant leadership at the time, again, associated with Dr. King, but Bayard Rustin and Fred Shuttlesworth and these kind of folks, were afraid of what she might say that was outside of their script, right? That had a lot to do with trying to come off right to the white power structure while still trying to get these gains, right, for Black folks and other folks. So she's one of our our ancestral heroes, right? Who's little known, but who was making history. Another thing said about her is that Malcolm X, again, who's one of the iconic figures of Black power, certainly, right? That he didn't mention a lot of other freedom fighters positively in his speeches, but he did mention Gloria Richardson. He had such respect for her, you know, that he does mention her in a speech. So, yeah.
And what's the student's reaction when that picture, it speaks volumes as you described it. Mm-hmm. You know, here's a Black woman in a segregated area pushing away the symbol of power, a symbol of something that could perpetuate violence upon somebody. What is the student's reaction to that?
I think they're in awe. You know, they sit there and look at that picture, and I give them the time to. I think there's a sense of surprise and shame that they don't know about someone like this. And I would like to think that it gives them a sense of what's possible, you know, what has been done, but also what is possible. Right? I think that's one of the consequences, one of the negative consequences of not knowing history well, right, is that we lack images and names and strategies of what people have done before, and therefore what I can identify with and what's possible for me today.
It's fascinating to hear you talk about your class. I'm curious if you have seen, you've only been in Buff State now for 4 years, mm-hmm. but have you seen a surge of interest in Africana studies?
I don't know if it's a surge, but there's growing interest. First of all, the same year I was hired at Buffalo State, fall of 2019, was the same year we got a major, right? We were offering a minor for decades. And obviously there was work done in the years leading up to me being hired as part of a cohort, actually, who were going to contribute to Africana Studies. But as we came in, it was announced that Africana Studies now offers a major. Then within months, we had COVID. Hmm. And so there was never really a chance to promote it or recruit until after, you know, after COVID. But after COVID, we went from one major, it grew to three in a few months, maybe in a year, year and a half, it was seven, and we are at 15 now.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And about the same number of minors. So yeah, I think it is growing as students recognize the power of it. Now, the problem is it is not a requirement, right? So like Intro to Africana Studies is not a requirement at Buffalo State.
Should it be?
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, yes. But it is, right now, what it serves to do is to allow students to check off that they satisfied a diversity requirement.
Okay.
So it is a choice or an option among several courses students can take to check the diversity box. The problem is if we get in one semester, let's say 150 to 200 students to take several sections of Intro to Black Studies, there are thousands more who aren't taking it. And if you get through your 4 years at Buffalo State and you didn't even take Intro to Black Studies, you might as well be 80 at that point, and you still don't know anything about Black people, you know, right. Black history, Black experiences, and so forth. So that's why I say, to the extent that we believe that understanding Black experience, Black history, and Black thought is vitally important to injecting a sense of justice and bringing back a sense of camaraderie and trust among us as Americans, then it's essential that that Africana study should be something learned, studied by students.
It isn't. It's interesting what you say about Buffalo State. My daughter actually just graduated from there last year, right? Yes, last year it was. And, you know, the one thing about taking her to the school, and I think one of the things she appealed to her is the sense of diversity at the school. It's, you know, there's a you know, large population of black students. It was not quite that way when I was there those many decades ago. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, though, there is, you know, as you're walking to the Union, you're walking around, you're going to be among a diverse population. Maybe there's still not the level of understanding that's needed.
I would agree with that. I think black as phenotype is different than black as philosophy, let's say.
Okay.
Right. So, yeah, I think there's value for sure in having a diverse student body. The opportunities for experiencing people of different backgrounds and hopefully warming up to that, appreciating and being able to speak with our fellow human beings, right? Hopefully some of that comes out of just that mere fact, right, of the diversity of the student body. But there's no guarantee that black students have black philosophy, right? There's no guarantee that they are also not socialized to think Eurocentrically about things, right?
So they most likely are.
In a lot of ways, they probably are out of necessity and circumstance, right? Knowing the history of the country. And so, yeah, even still, over and above just going to Buffalo State or going to a place that has a diverse student body, Africana Studies is different than that, right? And that, you know, this is where we offer systematic understanding, you know, of black thought, African-centered perspectives. And I would dare say that in just about every other discipline or major, you're probably getting something that's founded on a Eurocentric perspective, you know?
Right.
And so you're going to get that, right? No matter what you major in,
right.
you're going to get that assumed in your very being, right? So that's a continuation of how we're socialized, you know, more broadly, I think, in the society. So if you, right now, as it currently stands, if you want an alternative view, right, if you want to break out of the hegemonic normative, you know, narratives and ways of understanding, you first of all, you have to know that you're getting a Eurocentric based.
Sure.
Education in most of the majors, then you'd have to value a different, you know, cultural understanding and perspective, and then you'd have to make the choice to at least take the intro course to satisfy the diversity,
right?
If not major or minor in Africana Studies.
You mentioned a little while ago how you'd like to think and maybe even see inside your students who start learning and understanding Africana Studies, maybe a sense of peace, perhaps, of understanding themselves a little bit more. How about for you? Was that a situation for you as you grew as an individual?
That's a great question. My full name is Marcus Du Bois Watson. And I say that because some of our listeners may recognize these names, right? I'm 100% black of biracial parentage, okay? And I'm 50 years old. So in those days, I grew up in an age where there weren't really choices in terms of your identity. You were black or white in those days, right? So my parents, you know, we're also socialized in that kind of America, and both of them made sure that that I knew I was black, okay, and they thought it was nonsensical that I would think I was anything else, okay, so they agreed to name me after two black freedom fighters. One is Marcus Garvey, and the other W.E.B. Du Bois. Now I say that because I'm not sure how much my upbringing resonates or is common with other Black folks in terms of that kind of high degree of Black consciousness. So for me, my upbringing was more so from birth, being socialized within a family context and not having the kind of saturated exposure to other ideas through things like social media of just being prideful about being Black, you know, being prideful about being Black. I remember after my parents were divorced and my brother and I lived mostly with my father after that, my father may have had other things hung up on the wall, but the only thing I remember is a piece of white typing paper turned sideways with the with it written on it, February 21st, 1965.
Okay.
In my father's handwriting. And I probably didn't even know what it was for a while, but as I grew older and became more intellectually interested, right, I learned that that is the date of the assassination of one of our greatest ancestor heroes, Malcolm X.
Mm.
Right, that was the only thing on the wall. Right, and I'm named for two Black freedom fighters. My father changes his name legally from Robert to Uhuru. Uhuru meaning freedom in Swahili. So all that to say, what many students may be experiencing as a kind of jolt to their beings, you know, going through an intro to Africana studies course and then hopefully going on to major or minor in Africana studies, I think I experienced in a more gradual way growing up, you know. I'm very grateful for that. I'm grateful when I look back over my consciousness and its development from childhood till now, there's no major disruption or jolts, you know, like some of my students may be experiencing. What I see when I look back over my evolving consciousness is a love of self as a Black person and a pride in having African ancestry going all the way back. And I think because of that, I feel really healthy, you know? And it's not about disliking anybody else. I even said I come from biracial parentage, you know, but it's the world is different and better when you know who you are and love who you are, I think.
You also have spent considerable time on the continent of Africa. Your wife is from Ghana, so there's a great attachment there. You know, to talk to somebody who's had multiple experiences on the continent of Africa, I'm intrigued on a lot of different levels. But how much is for the first time stepping onto the continent, what that was like for you?
Yeah, traveling to the motherland was life transforming. For me, I first got to the African continent through the Peace Corps, which is a quasi-government organization that sends mostly young folks, often graduates of college, overseas to help other countries with their developmental needs, okay? So that brought me to the African continent. But when I applied, I was told, don't check a box that indicates you want to go to a very specific place.
Okay.
Because the people who review the essays, I was told, might see that as an indication of being a little close-minded. And they wanted someone who's just worldly and just would go anywhere and it doesn't matter. So I checked no preference.
Okay.
But I hoped and prayed, send me to the African continent.
Okay.
And they did send me to South Africa. In fact, I was part of the very first cohort of Peace Corps volunteers to ever go to South Africa. This was 1997. If we know our history, we know South Africa gains independence post-apartheid in 1994. So I was there just 3 years after apartheid ends and Nelson Mandela is elected president. And I remember being excited that I get to go to the African continent, mostly because when I had listened to some of the speeches of Malcolm X when I was a senior in high school, I don't know if he said it explicitly, but the message was there for sure that if you are Black, you should know the African continent. You should connect to the African continent, if not go to the African continent, as he did multiple times. I ended up spending 7 years living on the African continent, mostly in South Africa and Ghana, but I have visited 13 African countries. Ended up marrying someone from Ghana. We are 24 years married now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
4 children. That's pretty good, too.
Yep.
13 countries. What else would you like to say about going to those countries? What would you like to tell us about Africa?
Well, I think the low-hanging fruit for answering a question like that is that don't believe the stereotypes, mm-hmm. right? I think often Africa is depicted as the image of a starving child. There might be flies on the eyes of that child. There might be a distended belly or else warfare.
There's warfare on all the continents.
Right. There's warfare everywhere. And right. So those kinds of stereotypes, I would say do away with them. It's not that they're... Stereotypes don't capture something of reality, but it's just stereotypes capture, I would say, very little of a complex reality. There have been multiple times in my life driving out of a Walmart from Wyoming, where I used to live, to here, and meeting what looks like white folks who are panhandling or asking for a dollar, you know. As I'm driving out of Walmart, and I often give them something. But the point is, what if the United States was represented around the world with the image of that person asking for something outside of Walmart? You know, what if that was the image going all around the globe and they said, this is what America is? I mean, first of all, it would not capture the total complex reality of America, but also America wouldn't like to be viewed that way. Right. Or represented that way, right?
Yes.
Same way. The African continent, of course, reviles, being depicted, right, in those negative ways in a place like the United States. Africa is much more complex than that. There are metropolises there, enormous cities, Accra, Johannesburg, Cape Town, Dar es Salaam, so on and so forth. And one thing I would say about, every African place I went to, and there are 54 African countries, right? Africa is not one big country. Now, there are similarities across African cultures in the same way we can say there's something like Europe, right? There are differences there, but there's something in common that we can still say it's Europe, right? Same thing with the African continent. But there are 54 African countries. It is not one big country. But nevertheless, in all of the places I went, there is a stunning hospitality, right, that seems evident, wherever you go. I would even say about Ghana that if you go there and spend the first day or two there, if no one actually physically touched you in terms of holding your hand or giving you a hug, the way people talk to you and interact, for the most part, it almost feels like you're being hugged all the time, right? Which speaks to put it in simple terms, a collectivist, type of culture where people are socialized to understand their value, not against other people's value, but through other people, right? And so what that does is it, at a behavioral level, it really sensitizes people to how they speak, what they say. And that's where the way people are speaking to you, it always sort of feels like you're being pulled closer in a good way, almost like into an embrace or a hug.
That was Marcus Watson, an associate professor of Africana Studies and Individualized Studies at Buffalo State University. We close today's show with Thomas O'Neill White's conversation with Rashawn Smalls, the program manager for Tobacco-Free Erie Niagara through CAI Global, as they discuss what it means to advance tobacco-free communities and help eliminate secondhand smoke.
Can you give us a little bit of a background of Chikatilly Associates? What goes on over there?
Yeah, sure. So again, my name is Rashawn Smalls, and I am blessed to serve as the Community Engagement Program Manager for Advancing Tobacco-Free Communities, which I'll have opportunity to talk about a little bit later. But that is a project of Chikatilly Associate, or short CAI for short, CAI Global. And CAI is a public health organization, not-for-profit, which has been around for probably about 45 years or so. I believe it was 1979. And we're a capacity-building organization. And so essentially, our mission is to use the transformative power of education and research to create a more aware, a more healthy, a more compassionate, a more equitable world. So the work that we do fits within through that social lens.
And so, and then your role in the organization is a broad approach to eliminating cigarette use.
Yeah, and so that is certainly one way of describing it. So the work that we do, I want to just simply start by saying that Advancing Tobacco-Free Communities is a statewide project. It is part of New York State's chronic disease prevention agenda. And so Advancing Tobacco-Free Communities, there is this focus on supporting New York State's smoke-free norms. There is an individual like myself in just about every county throughout the state. I and my coworker Amanda, who is here today, we both serve as program managers, and we work across both Erie and Niagara County. She does Reality Check, which is the youth component to the work that we do, and her focus is on developing youth leaders to use their voice to message against how tobacco industry is targeting our community. And my role on the other end is to complement that right there through community engagement. And the focus is on, again, supporting New York State smoke-free norms through a number of different approaches or initiatives.
So before we get into initiatives, mm-hmm. what are tobacco-free norms?
And so when you think about tobacco-free norms, let me give it some, try to give you what tobacco-free norms isn't, or an example of what a norm is, for instance, mm-hmm. right? So let's think about stop signs, right? Everyone can relate to stop signs. Some of us like them, some of us hate them, yeah. You know, especially when you got to get to where you got to go to, right? So stop signs are there for a reason. Mm-hmm. Stop signs stop people from, it creates order, right? It creates it's a rule that helps save lives in many instances, right? Because if we didn't have stop signs, we'd all be running through and moving at our own pace, at our own tune, and we'd end up crashing. Mm-hmm. So there are laws, you know, even texting while driving, right? That right there is distracting, and it could cause harm because you may not see the car that's going in the opposite direction, or you may swerve and hit another car. So those are rules or policies, right? Norms that have been ingrained in our way of life. So when you think about smoke-free norms, the goal here is to protect and save lives by reducing exposure to secondhand smoke, right? Because if, for instance, I live in a multi-unit housing complex, right? And 70% of the occupants smoke in this housing complex. And I, among the 30%, don't smoke, mm-hmm. right? But every day I'm going to work and my clothes smell like tobacco. Right. My 5-year-old infant is inhaling secondhand smoke from my neighbor. Right. So we talk about creating or working to establish smoke-free norms. Is it about, if I live in this housing complex, do I have a right to breathe clean air? And how do we establish that right there? You know, and one of the ways that we've worked on it, and we'll talk about it later, is by working with multi-unit housing complexes, property owners and property managers to adopt and implement smoke-free policies, which in effect restrict smoking and reduce secondhand smoke. And You know, and that's, I guess in some ways people don't like it, but the reality is what it does is it's a policy, a rule, but eventually it becomes a way of life, like stop signs, like texting while not texting while driving, or not drinking while driving, and some of the other smart public health policies which save lives.
So working with these property owners to get that policy in, you know, has there been pushback from policy owners? I'm sure there's pushback from people living in those units who smoke, but from a property manager's perspective, have they been like fully on board?
Yeah, well, that's the straight cut answer is no, right? Because with any type of implementation of policy comes with its challenges, right?
Yes.
And in COVID sort of exacerbated many issues, right? And one of the issues are many landlords struggled to get their money simply from tenants, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, I'm telling you can't smoke in the building, why the hell I want to live here?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I should be able to do what I want to do in my apartment. And, you know, and so that's one challenge that landlords face. And that's why sometimes our work has fallen on deaf ears, because landlords are saying, I simply want to, you know, just collect my rent. But on the other hand, you know, there are collateral consequences to smoking, which has sat or resonated well. You know, it reduces the amount of work that I have to do to repair the apartment, right? You know, in terms of the coloration of the walls, in terms of the smoke in the ventilation system, in terms of, you know, potential fire issues which are caused by smoking. And so those things are appealing to property owners and property managers, and just the public health issue as we spoke to earlier. And so those things are attractive, and as we've done this work, it seems that we're trending toward smoke-free multi-unit housing policies across the board. HUD was one of the first to, you know, as a governmental agency, to adopt a smoke-free policy in all HUD buildings. So this is it's a real issue. I think we recognize that secondhand smoke, as the U.S. Surgeon General has said, there's no safe level of exposure to it. If you can smell it, you inhale it. And if you are inhaling it, it can exacerbate a number of health-related issues that you already have, or create some.
So moving from tobacco-free norms, talk a little bit about what tobacco-free Erie and Niagara does. I mean, you did a little bit, get more into that, please.
Yeah, so our work is very, very comprehensive. And when I say very, very, it is very, very comprehensive. We've talked about multi-unit housing work, right? Engaging on that level. What we haven't talked about is tobacco-free outdoors, for instance. That would be another initiative that we have. And as I spoke earlier about the Surgeon General's report, there is no safe level of exposure to secondhand smoke. So when you're at the playground, when you're at the park, when you're at the beach, when you're in these outdoor spaces, right? If you're being exposed to secondhand smoke, it can cause harm and will cause harm with repeated exposure. And so our work involves working with elected officials, working with community members to create this sort of education around protecting these spaces, these outdoor spaces, working with employers as well to protect these outdoor spaces. Because if I'm at a space 8, 9, 16 hours a day, right, which we work, and I'm going, you know, and people are allowed to smoke, then that's impacting my health. So we work across not just housing, but also tobacco-free outdoors work sites. And we also have a focus on retail, right? We look at how can we prevent tobacco industry from using marketing to attract, to attract new users, to attract, to continue to perpetuate and sell tobacco products. So we look at a number of different approaches in terms of retail and how the tobacco industry is marketing its product as well.
And so your agenda also includes, you know, bringing together stakeholders, to mobilize the community around four priority activities. Can you tell us what those priorities are?
Yeah, and so community engagement is central to the work that we do, right? So we want to make sure that we are creating this sort of awareness. We work directly with communities via listening sessions, via just having conversations. For instance, you know, every November we have, you know, what we call Great American Smokeout, which is really an international movement. And it's about challenging people on one day to not smoke. And we mm-hmm. just create this sort of a educational awareness piece. We may meet at the Delavan Grotta Community Center with members of the community, and we invite the whole city of Buffalo to be there to support people who are smoking, because our focus is not against people who smoke. Our focus is against tobacco industry and how they're marketing and targeting our communities. So we are about supporting people and helping provide resources for people. But the focus is, again, just about creating that awareness so that people know that there are resources to help them quit. And so community engagement is central to the work that we're doing. Also, we talk about community mobilization. We want the community to be upfront, to use their voice, to have power, to have influence. We talk about government policymaker education. Our focus in my role, my capacity as community engagement program manager, is not to advocate for a particular law, but just simply to educate elected officials about what is happening in a community. Mm-hmm. And so government policymaker education is central to the work that we're doing, as well as advocacy with organizational decision makers, employers. How are we connecting with HR representatives? Do they have smoke-free policies? And how can we assist them with adopting and implementing these policies? So those are different approaches that we have to actually helping to support New York State smoke-free norms.
I hope the messaging on smoke out is clear, because might attract the wrong folks.
No. You know, it's interesting. We've gotten some stuff, some smoke for that. You know, we've got some smoke about that. But Great American Smoke Out, right? It does sort of play into that right there. But you know, I mean, it's that day where we work with people who do smoke and encourage them, bring them together, encourage them, and let them know that we are supportive of you know, their efforts to quit. And I just, on a personal note, you know, I've had many family members who smoke. My wife smokes, and that's always a challenge because smoking is so personal, and because nicotine is so addictive. You know, I mean, you have to be very sensitive and approach it with compassion, understanding that, you know, there's a habit which is deeply ingrained. And one of the things that I, you know, adopt from my professional life is policy. You know, and what I mean is that in my home, you know, we have a policy of no smoking in the home. And so, you know, that helps in a number of ways. I think one of the things it does, it just makes her conscious of the fact that she is smoking, right? And it also, during the wintertime, what we've noticed is that she smokes less, because if she has to go outside to smoke and it's cold outside, she says, you know, that's one less cigarette I'm going to smoke, or I'm going to cut this one short. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So policy on it, that seems to be so trivial, but on a larger level, policy works because it makes people conscious of what they're doing, and it makes them less likely to do it. And even restricts what they can do in certain spaces.
I wanted to talk about these findings from the Tobacco Retail Environment Observations that CAI did.
Great.
It was 2022?
Well, actually, that should be 2022, 2023.
Okay, yes.
So sort of kind of major. So that's our year four. You're referring to our year four local data collection report, which essentially was an observation of, I believe, 88 stores in three districts throughout the city of Buffalo.
Largely on the east side.
East side, correct.
Yes.
I believe it was Lovejoy, it may have been Ellicott,
and Maston, I believe.
Yeah, Maston District. And we've since done the remaining six districts as well, which is a report that's currently being worked on for our year five local data collection report. I'll make sure that you have that once it's completed. But that is our year four local data collection report of the three districts. And essentially what we did was, when we talk about community mobilization, six community members who we refer to as community champions, were trained and on how to do observations using the forms, and were tasked with going through those three districts and looking at the prevalence of tobacco retail marketing, product sales, and among other things, and what the findings are in that report that you have in front of you. And some of the key findings that we talk about, you know, which is really borderline enforcement. We looked at how there were children in stores selling tobacco, right? Children in stores. Now, in New York State, there's, thankfully, we have a 21 and over law for purchasing right. tobacco.
Yes.
But in certain stores in throughout the districts that are meant have been mentioned, there were children selling tobacco, right? There were flavored tobacco products, which technically are illegal mm-hmm. products, right? And not coincidentally, all of them, I believe, with the exception of one store, sold some form of mentholated tobacco product, right? And, you know, we've already, I think it's well known that, you know, in inner city communities, there is a greater prevalence of mentholated tobacco products, a greater sale and presence of them. 85% right. of black smokers use mentholated tobacco products. 85%. Think about that. Compared to 30% of white smokers. And that disparity is not coincidental. This is a part of a historic development in of marketing and targeting of African American communities back in the 50s, right? You know, and I did my research, you know, less than 5% of black smokers use mentholated tobacco products. In every decade since, there's been this exponential increase where today, from 5% in the 50s to 85% in today. And some would even say 89% of black smokers who smoke use mentholated tobacco products. And you say, well, that's a choice. It isn't.
Right. It isn't. It's ingrained.
It's part of the social norm.
Right.
And so we talk about social norms. Tobacco industry has normalized, African-Americanized, as, you know, Philip Gardner would say, Dr. Philip Gardner would say, African-Americanized mentholated tobacco products. They've made it a part of the black culture.
Right.
It's cool, like, to smoke Newports and, you know.
And we were talking earlier that, you know, you could pick up Jet, you could pick up Ebony mm-hmm. back in the day and see these, you know, menthol ads.
Yeah, no
Some
question.
Of your favorite actors, actresses,
yes.
Recording artists, you know, with that cigarette in their mouth.
Yeah, that
it's
was
almost like Billy D with the St. Ides.
Come on. And that's how real it was. Like, this is how creative tobacco industry was. Man, they were ahead of the curve when it came to hiring execs. They mm-hmm. hire blacks. I mean, before most other industries were doing it.
Right.
You know, they've invested, poured millions of dollars in black schools, historically black universities. Man, they figured out this is a market that we need to exploit. And the way we do it is pour money into it. You know, so when you talk about the advertisement in Jet magazines, like, you know, I'm old enough to remember seeing those advertisements in Ebony, Jet, mm-hmm. and all of these health magazines and culturally relevant magazines for black. That was targeted and intentional. You know, tobacco industry has creatively, found a way to ingrain themselves into the cultural landscape of what it, the African-American communities.
And then one of the other key findings are menthol cigarettes are widely available across the three districts. 100% of the stores observed across Ellicott, Fillmore, and Lovejoy districts, menthol products were mm-hmm. available. I find that astounding.
It is. And when you think about it, too, I think we were talking about it earlier, right? You know, the overall prevalence of it, right, is inescapable, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So repeated exposure to something will have an influence on how you think and how you behave, right? So it's not coincidental why, you know, so many black people prefer menthol tobacco, because it is the most available product.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the Powerwall?
Nice. Yeah. Powerwall. So that's for people. We're not talking about the lottery here. Yeah, Powerball. We're talking about what in tobacco, the tobacco control landscape, we talk about this Powerwall, right? So you go into a corner store and, you know, and I'm sure all the listeners can have experience connect to this, right? You go into a store and, you know, you go to buy a bag of chips, you buy, you know, whatever, wine cooler, whatever you're going to purchase, right? And when you get to the cash register and you look up and it's at eye level, whether you're a kid or whether you're, you know, an adult, and you see this colorful array of products, mm-hmm. and they're all tobacco, vape, some sort of nicotine product.
Yes.
Right? It is as clear as the sky on a, you know, a warm spring day. You can look up and see it and you saying, wow. For children, a child looking at this, you're saying, what the hell is it? It's colorful. I like it.
Yeah, right.
As an adult, you've already been, let me get the Newport 100s.
Right, yeah. You're
green,
almost programmed.
No, let me get the green pack, not the red pack.
Yeah.
It's in. I want you to understand this. The tobacco industry, that Powerwall is so influential. Tobacco industry pays to have that real estate in every store that you encounter, every store you go in, that is reserved for the tobacco industry products. That is how they've continued to influence smokers and create this next generation of smokers, is by investment in that particular wall.
Yes, and
that's what the story is.
And it's also how you mentioned, very intersectional.
Yeah, definitely. It certainly intersects with race. It certainly intersects with economics. Now you mention it, you know, in terms of the race, I think we've already spoken about, you know, menthol and African American, you know, users. I want to just put this number out here: 45,000 black lives. 45,000 black lives are lost every year in this country as a result of tobacco-related disease and illnesses. That is more than homicides. That is more than suicides. That is more than HIV and AIDS. That is more than accidents combined. 45,000 black lives lost every year in this country as a result of tobacco-related disease and illnesses in the African-American community, right? That doesn't even include vaping, you mm-hmm. know, and the untold story with that. You know, in terms of how tobacco industry is marketed, that and how that's becoming more prevalent in African American communities. You know, how that's affecting youth overall, the health and well-being of youth.
And I know we spent a lot of time talking about implementation for the inner city, mm-hmm. especially Buffalo's east side, but this is tobacco-free Erie and Niagara.
Correct.
So you have outreach in the rural areas. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, I appreciate just on a personal level being able to do that work in such a diverse community, because it allows for me to see so much more about how diverse, you know, Western New York is. You know, I could be
because you're a kid from the east side.
Yeah, I'm right from the Fruit Belt, right here, you know, right here in the Fruit Belt, and I could be in Springville in one afternoon, and the next day I could be in North Tonawanda, mm-hmm. which is where I live, by the way. Now, let me just be completely transparent, you know, working with Community Health Alliance of North Tonawanda, you know, on some policy and community work, right? And it gives me an opportunity to see what the needs are, the unique set of needs are in those communities. What are the social issues? What are the health issues? And to say, hey, I never thought of it that way. How can I add value to the work that you're doing? But at the heart of it too, when you go, there are some parallels. There are a lot of different common issues. You know, flavors and vaping is impacting every community. You go to Springville, they're talking about the prevalence of vaping. You go to North Tonawanda, you're talking about the prevalence of vaping. You go to Niagara Falls, you talk about these vape products and how children are getting caught in school with them, how children are being suspended, and how children are being impacted in terms of their development, their brain development. And the less time you spend in school, the least likely you are to graduate.
Correct.
And learn. And mm-hmm. so this is something that is impacting, you know, not just black kids in Niagara Falls or Buffalo, but in Springville as well, in Wilson as well, in Marilla, mm-hmm. in Elma, in these other places that I've had the opportunity to go to. And at the end of the day, there is a human element.
Yes.
There's a human element that I think connects all of us. And whenever I'm in any room, whether I'm the only black man person in that room, you know, I find a space. I try to connect with the humanity of people there. You know what I mean? And that's where I feel comfortable at. And I find a space to add value to whatever community that I'm in.
Yeah. And then tailoring that education to the communities, as we were talking earlier, again, vaping is kind of like a very broad issue, mm-hmm. but you know, if you're in the city of Niagara Falls or you're in Buffalo, you may be talking about having conversations about menthol cigarettes,
mm-hmm.
but if you're out in the rural areas, you may be talking about, you know, regular like Marlboros or Camels or the nicotine.
Yeah,
pouches,
the Zen
like
pouches.
Exactly.
And the different sort of spitless tobacco pouches, right? So there are certain cultural pieces that, you know, that you find to be true, and you just try to understand what they are, you know, instead of presuming that you know. Mm-hmm. And I resist going into communities thinking that I have an answer. I go there thinking that I can be a part of helping find a solution. My expertise in understanding policy and understanding health equity and understanding, tobacco, I bring that to the table, but I don't know what the unique set of needs are. I listen and try to understand, and then I weigh in on how, you know, being a part of the creative process of finding a solution, a policy solution, is where I think, you know, we sit at. And I think that's one of the hallmarks of the organization that I work for, Cicatelli Associates.
And that will do it for Producer Picks. We thank our guests, Marcus Watson and Rashawn Smalls. If you missed anything or want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts or on the Amplify BTPM app. Each episode is online at wbfo.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thanks for listening.